This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
finds dozens more civilians lose their lives in fresh Israeli strikes in Gaza as the regime's genocide rages on across the blockaded Palestinian territory. The United States presses ahead with its brutal military aggression against Yemen, killing and injuring over two dozen civilians in the latest airstrikes. And also in our headlines, China slams U.S. allegations about jeopardizing the Panama Canal's operations, urging Washington to stop blackmail and plundering of Panama and other regional countries. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Top story, Israel's killing machine continues to massacre innocent civilians in Gaza, with more women and children falling victim to the regime's brutal attacks. Gaza officials say nearly 60 people were killed within 24 hours. One of the latest attacks killed two civilians, including a child, in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. A separate attack targeted a tent sheltering displaced people in the Al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunis, killing six Palestinians, including three children, and wounding several others. Another strike in the same area killed two more civilians. Gaza's health ministry says nearly 1,500 civilians, including over 100 children, have been killed and over 3,600 injured since the resumption of the genocide on March 18th. The overall death toll now tops 50,800, including 211 journalists, with nearly 115,700 others injured. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese has urged the international community to stop treating Israel as a normal state and recognize it as an apartheid regime committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. Well, in continuation of the Israeli policy of using humanitarian supplies as a tool of war against the Palestinians in Gaza, the regime has also systematically crippled the ability of NGOs operating there. Aid groups are unable to cope with the immense pressure due to the catastrophic humanitarian conditions. Our correspondent Motiel Mosabe reports from Deir al-Balah.
Since the onset of the Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, it has become unambiguous that the Israeli regime uses the humanitarian needs as a tool to blackmail the Palestinian resistance on one hand and collectively punish the entire population on the other. It was not enough for the occupation forces to close Gaza crossings and prevent the flow of the humanitarian supplies. Neither was it enough to ruin all life sectors in Gaza. They proceeded vigorously to narrow the leeway of NGOs to operate.
Since the start of the genocidal war on Gaza, the Israeli regime has been targeting relief workers from international and local organizations deliberately. We have hundreds of those individuals, many of them foreigners, who were killed while helping the Palestinian people. This is a flagrant violation of all international and humanitarian laws, because those workers must be protected. We comprehend that the main aim of these systematic attacks is to deepen the suffering of the Palestinian people in light of the Israeli policy of using the humanitarian conditions as a method of war.
Considering that 2.2 million Palestinians in Gaza, 70% women and children, are utterly relying on those supplies and services provided by international and local NGOs, is enough to paint a tragic picture of the current situation in Gaza. Those organizations that were striving over the past months to secure some amounts of food items to the families torn apart in the displacement camps are no longer able to get even the minimum percentage of the life-saving materials.
The Israeli regime has been tightening its suffocating siege on Gaza by preventing the entry of the humanitarian needs, which not only plunges the people into catastrophic situations, but exposes the ability of humanitarian organizations to respond to the crises. Those organizations have been grappling with Israeli tactics used against them. Nowadays, zero trucks of goods, medical supplies, and fuel are allowed, which means that the organizations will shut their doors soon. The world needs to take decisive actions to stop these crimes against Gazans.
Since the resumption of the genocidal war on Gaza, a plethora of warnings and statements were unleashed by the NGOs, sounding the alarms of them being unable to function in Gaza due to Israeli attacks that claimed hundreds more lives in addition to the prevention of the basic supplies. Having 25 World Food Programme-supported bakeries in Gaza shut down could be just the beginning of the absolute famine that will be a recipe of a death sentence for the entire population. With every brutal measure taken against the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime presents more poignant evidences that it has no red lines when it comes to shattering the lives of the Palestinian people, and it reflects in the abhorrent silence and inaction of the international community. Mutab Msabih, Deir al-Balah City, the central area of Gaza Strip.
We're now joined by Abu Bakr Abed, who's with us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, to bring us up to speed on the ongoing Israeli genocidal massacre that continues as we speak all across Gaza.
Yes, so the Israeli army is still striking Gaza in every single inch, starting from Rafah, this area that has been turned into a buffer zone under the control of the Israeli military for many days right now, and all Palestinians who are sheltering there or who are original residents of the city are now taking shelter or taking refuge elsewhere in Maasi, Rafah, or in central Gaza, particularly Deir al-Balah. But overnight, and since overnight, to be honest, the Israeli military has been hitting Rafah, several areas inside Rafah, with barrages of missiles from the warplanes. This is in addition to the fact that they have been bombarding it and booby-trapping it with several explosives, and we could even hear the sounds of the explosions from here, from where we are in central Gaza. And the explosions were just terrifying and something unprecedented, because the Israelis, after creating or establishing another corridor in those western areas of Rafah, Marash corridor, now is making sure that this city will not be touched again by Palestinians and will belong to the Israelis and add to another area apart from the areas, the border regions, the Philadelphia corridor that is on the borders with the southern Israel or the southern occupied Palestinian territory. So there have been barrages of rockets there have been relentless bombardments. Israeli tanks and shells, along with Apache helicopters, have been opening fire relentlessly on those areas and on those civilian structures. And anyone in the middle between Khan Yunus and Rafah was subjected to severe attacks and Israeli fire if anyone passing by or passed by in those areas. And in Khan Yunus, another attack just hit a family home in Khan Yunus, leaving or causing several casualties. And here in central Gaza, we didn't manage to sleep at all, because the Israeli artillery shelling hasn't stopped. We can hear further blasts every 5 minutes here in central Gaza, because Israeli tanks are advancing on the eastern outskirts, and in the northern regions of Al-Nusayrat camp, the Israeli tanks are also shelling those regions and those civilian infrastructures and those buildings. So there's a huge intensification of the artillery shelling in central Gaza and along the eastern outskirts of Khan Yunis and Rafah. The same has happened in northern Gaza, in Al Shaja'iyya and Zaytun neighborhoods, two have been ordered to evacuate just a few days ago, and some Palestinians have stayed there, but Israel is still pounding and shelling those areas.
Thanks a lot, Abu Bakr Abed, joining us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. A large group of pro-Palestine activists and non-governmental organizations have held a mass protest in the French capital, Paris. Protesters denounced Israel's genocidal war on the besieged Gaza Strip while expressing solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Every day we are demonstrating in Paris, women, men and children too, to expose this genocide and to say that nobody can silence us.
I just want the government to take a stand, to recognize the state of Palestine, and to stop welcoming a war criminal like Netanyahu in the country.
The French protesters strongly condemned Israel's attacks on hospitals, journalists, and aid workers. They also denounced hypocrisy of the Western states in dealing with the Gaza crisis. Participants criticized the French government's support for Israel, calling for an immediate end to Paris's cooperation with Tel Aviv They carry banners and Palestinian flags while chanting slogans demanding the arrest of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Demonstrators vow to continue daily protests in various cities until the genocide in Gaza comes to an end. Israeli forces continue to conduct violent raids on Palestinian towns and cities across the West Bank, this time targeting educational institutions in the occupied territory. An Israeli raid on Al-Quds University campus in the town of Abu Dis, east of the occupied city of Al-Quds, has left nearly 30 students injured. The Palestinian Red Crescent says students suffered burns and suffocation caused by tear gas canisters. The regime's forces also stormed six UN-run schools across the occupied territory, announcing plans to close those facilities. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees denounced the raids, describing the closure orders as a violation of the right of refugee children to education. UNRWA also called Israel's closure orders a violation of the regime's obligations under international law. It said UN-run schools are protected by the privileges and immunities of the United Nations. The United States has carried out more deadly airstrikes on Yemen as Washington continues its brutal military campaign against civilians in the Arab country. According to Yemeni media, U.S. airstrikes on the western province of Hodeidah killed at least six people and injured 16 others, including two women and three children. They said the figure is likely to rise as many people are still trapped under the rubble. The strikes reportedly targeted the port city's Al-Hawak district. Local sources also cited a separate U.S. strike on a communications network in Amran Governorate, north of the capital, Sana'a. 10 air raids also hit a district east of Sana'a. More airstrikes targeted Dhamar and Ib governorates, including three raids on a number of farms west of Dhamar city. The attacks came just a day after Yemen's army targeted a military target in Israel and U.S. warships in the Red Sea. Washington started its air campaign against Yemen on March 15th. After Sana'a resumed retaliatory attacks on Israel in response to the regime's renewed genocide in Gaza. Iran's foreign minister says the upcoming nuclear talks in Muscat will serve as a test to gauge Washington's seriousness in addressing long-standing tensions. Abbas Araghchi added that the talks will be a new opportunity for diplomacy with the United States, which has a long history of unilateralism. Araghchi also added, the focus of negotiations will be on fostering transparency and building trust regarding the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program in return for the lifting of U.S. sanctions. The remarks come as Tehran and Washington are set to hold indirect high-level talks on Iran's nuclear program in Oman on Saturday. According to media reports, Araghchi will be heading the Iranian team in the meetings, and the U.S. will be represented by Trump's special envoy for the Middle East, Steve Witkoff. Well, Iran has opened its largest and most sophisticated nuclear medicine center in the capital, Tehran. The center was opened ahead of the National Nuclear Technology Day, which is marked on Wednesday. The facility is equipped with advanced imaging systems that allow better treatment of medical conditions. Kisumi Shahadi has visited the facility and sent us this report.
A beacon of hope for countless patients. Rasul Akram Hospital in Tehran now hosts Iran's largest and most advanced nuclear medicine center, officially opening its doors with a state-of-the-art department equipped with PET-CT and SPECT imaging systems.
We have opened this new nuclear medicine ward spanning 600 square meters, which includes the latest PET and SPECT scanners. These advanced tools will significantly improve the diagnosis and treatment of medical conditions, particularly for cancer patients, as the center is now equipped with the most cutting-edge technology available globally.
We have successfully installed advanced scanners in this center, marking a significant step in utilizing radiopharmaceuticals for nuclear medicine. This technology will greatly benefit our patients and enhance their care.
This milestone marks a significant leap in Iran's medical capabilities, seamlessly combining cutting-edge technology with expert care to redefine diagnostic and therapeutic standards.
This new ward was essential for the hospital. As the first such center at Iran University of Medical Sciences, it will significantly contribute to early diagnosis and more effective treatment plans. The ability to visualize both function and anatomy simultaneously greatly enhances the precision of our work.
Meanwhile, with the PET and SPECT scanners in operation and specialists delivering care to patients, concerns about long waiting times have been effectively alleviated.
This cutting-edge technology not only enhances diagnostic precision, but also embodies a commitment to providing the highest quality healthcare to patients.
The opening comes just before Iran's National Nuclear Technology Day, reflecting the country's increasing reliance on nuclear advancements, particularly in healthcare. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Well, China has slammed U.S. claims about jeopardizing the Panama Canal's operations, urging Washington to halt blackmail and plundering of Panama and other countries of the region. The remarks came after U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said during a visit to Panama that the United States will not allow China to threaten the Panama Canal's operations and integrity. In response, China's embassy in Panama refuted Hegseth's claim about interfering in the canal's operations. It stressed that China has never taken part in the management or operation of the Panama Canal, nor has it interfered in issues concerning the waterway. Describing Hegseth's comments as irresponsible, the embassy said the U.S. has orchestrated a campaign based on the China threat theory to undermine cooperation between China and Panama. It added that China has always respected Panama's sovereignty with regards to the canal. After Donald Trump took office as the U.S. president, he vowed to take back the canal and counter what he called China's disproportionate influence over it. U.S. stocks, the dollar, and crude oil prices have faced sharp declines as the U.S. prepares to implement the new Trump tariffs. On Tuesday, the U.S. Trade Representative confirmed that the tariffs on nearly 100 nations introduced by President Donald Trump on April the 2nd will take effect on Wednesday. These include a 104% tariff on Chinese imports, the shifting headlines on tariffs and fear of a prolonged trade war between the world's two biggest economies triggered significant volatility in financial markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by more than 300 points. The S&P 500 dropped nearly 80 points, ending below 5,000 for the first time in almost a year. The NASDAQ plunged over 2%. The U.S. dollar saw its weakest performance in weeks. Meanwhile, crude oil prices also fell on the same day. As these tariffs come into force, their ripple effects on the global economy remain a growing concern. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد. اینها چیزای لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
The supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep, and hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The time has come for Muslims to rise above their differences and harness the immense power of a united Ummah. Palestine, and indeed the entire world, cannot wait any longer. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "The Islamic world, once a beacon of unity and resistance against colonialism, now stands fractured and weakened. This fragmentation is the result of decades of internal failures and cunning ploys by external powers to create fissures in the fabric of the Ummah. Propaganda, sectarianism, and the prioritization of narrow national interest have eroded the collective strength of the Arab and Muslim world. At the heart of this disunity lies the failure to rally around the Palestinian cause, a 70-year-old struggle that remains a litmus test for Arab and Muslim solidarity. This failure has not only emboldened Israel's settler colonial expansionist ambitions, but also exposed the vulnerabilities of the Arab world to external manipulation and internal division. To better understand the current state of the Arab world, we must revisit the early 20th century, a time when Arab nations fought valiantly against colonial powers." From the Arab revolt of 1916 against the Ottoman Empire to the resistance against French and British mandates in Syria, Iraq, and Palestine, the Arab world was united in its quest for independence and self-determination. The shared identity of Muslims, Christians, and Jews as people of the book fostered a sense of brotherhood that transcended religious or ethnic differences. However, the late 19th and early 20th centuries saw a shift. The oppressive policies of the Ottoman Empire, coupled with British meddling and the aftermath of the First World War, led Arab intellectuals to embrace European-inspired nationalism. Leaders like Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt and Habib of Tunisia emerged as champions of pan-Arabism, yet over time, Arab nationalism, instead of fostering solidarity, has deepened divisions and given rise to ethnocentric and individualist approaches. Leaving the region to become a patchwork of competing nation-states, each prioritizing its own interests over the collective good, this fragmentation was exploited by colonial powers, which saw an opportunity to feed on the carcass of a broken Ummah, redraw maps, and sow discord to maintain control over the resource-rich West Asia region. One could argue that perhaps the Arab nationalistic shift could have lasted the test of time, but the creation of the illegitimate Israeli regime in 1948 marked a definitive turning point. The Nakba, which marked the expulsion of over 700,000 Palestinians from their homes and the subsequent occupation of Palestinian lands, exposed the limitations of Arab nationalism. Despite initial solidarity, Arab nations failed to translate their rhetoric into effective action. The 1967 Six-Day War with the Zionist regime dealt a devastating blow to the Arab nationalistic aspirations. With the regime occupying the West Bank, Gaza, East Al-Quds, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. The U.S.-led Camp David Accords of 1978, which saw Egypt sign a deal with the occupying regime, dealt the final blow, further shattering the illusion of Arab unity. These developments revealed the inability of Arab leaders to prioritize collective action over individual interest. The wave of normalization agreements in recent years between some Arab states and the Zionist regime, a blatant betrayal of the Palestinian cause, further emboldened Israel's expansionist ideas and threatened the future of many Arab countries. Nationalism, once a rallying cry for liberation, has proven inadequate in addressing the challenges facing the Arab world. While it is clear that the Arab nationalistic ideals have failed, the question remains, what other solution is there? It's time Arabs and Muslims, in general, return to their source of power and embrace their Islamic identity. According to recent data, there are at least 2 billion Muslims in the world, with that number steadily increasing. This means a united Ummah could wield unparalleled geopolitical, economic, and moral influence. The collective strength of 2 billion Muslims, spanning diverse nations and cultures, is a force that no single power or alliance could easily ignore. From military power to economic leverage to providing a more humane, justice-oriented way of life, a stark contrast to the materialistic, profit-oriented Western doctrine that has dragged the entire world to a near-catastrophic environmental disaster. The opportunity and potential are too enormous to list. The question then is, what are the challenges preventing this unity from materializing? We cannot find answers without examining the role of propaganda and sectarianism. Western powers and their allies have skillfully exploited sectarian divides to keep the Arab world fragmented. By framing regional conflicts as ancient religious feuds, they have diverted attention from their own geopolitical ambitions. For example, the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 exacerbated sectarian tensions, leading to the rise of Daesh terrorist group. Instead of addressing the root causes of extremism, Western governments used Al-Qaeda and Daesh as a pretext to target Shia groups and governments in the region, while using propaganda to convince many Sunni Arabs to view Iran and Hezbollah as enemies rather than allies. The brutality of terrorist outfits such as Daesh did not discriminate when it came to killing Shias, Sunnis, Christians, and other minority groups. And it was Shia-led groups that stood, fought, protected, and liberated lands otherwise occupied by these extremist groups. The Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, while mainly Shias, played a crucial role in liberating cities like Mosul and Tikrit. In Syria, Hezbollah, Iranian, and Syrian resistance forces were instrumental in breaking the siege of Aleppo. And yet today, many Arabs and Sunni Muslims view Iran and other Shia resistance groups in the same lens as Israel, with many believing that Shias are worse than the Israeli occupation. Even though since the Al-Aqsa storm operation, while many Arab countries have been paralyzed, it was Hezbollah, Yemen, Iraqi resistance forces, and Iran that have given everything, including their blood, to support Palestinians. And then, is the way forward? What is that? The Ummah will remain in a perpetual state of war, an endless conflict, if it fails to discard these sectarian narratives and mindsets. It must hold to account those who fund and propagate extremism and acknowledge the contributions of all groups in the fight against terrorism. It must also renew its commitment to the Palestinian cause, not as a symbolic issue, but as a central pillar of Arab Islamic identity and solidarity. This also includes holding Israel accountable for its actions. Arab leaders must recognize that Israel's expansionist policies pose a direct threat to their own security, and normalization agreements, far from bringing peace, will only further render their countries weakened and another easy pick for Israel's expansionist ambitions, just as we are witnessing in Syria. The European Union shows that unity is possible, even among nations with a history of conflict. If the Islamic Ummah can overcome its divisions and unite, it will not only secure the liberation of Palestine, but also restore its dignity and reclaim its place as a global leader in justice and human rights. The time has come for Muslims to rise above the differences and harness the immense power of a united Ummah. Palestine, and indeed the entire world, cannot wait any longer.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir. Black and white.
Ukraine, a foreseen tragedy.
¿Quién pudo haber pensado alguna vez desde el 2014 cuando se inicia.
Who could have imagined, since 2014, when the ultra-reactionary, even fascist and Nazi movements began in Ukraine,
hasta la intervención especial de las tropas rusas,
leading up to the special intervention of Russian troops, that Ukraine might serve Western interests in fragmenting Russia.
De fragmentar a Rusia, dividirla y dejarla en países.
Dividing it into distinct countries, some serving Germany, others England, others the United States, and feeding off each other economically. The old decadent Europe looking for the resources that exist, from skilled Russian workforce to natural resources.
Tanto humanos, desde una mano de obra calificada, rusa, como naturales.
That was a fantasy, a gamble destined for failure. Today, Ukraine cannot participate. Donald Trump tells it, you have no cards to offer.
No tienes ninguna carta que ofrecer. Más allá.
Beyond the madness of going to World War III, that is not yet on the agenda in the interests of U.S. imperialism.
Los intereses del imperialismo norteamericano no está todavía colocada en la agenda.
Ukraine has to industrialize. A country without industry, without the capacity to produce what it needs to go to war, cannot get involved in a conflict of global proportions, especially against the enemy the United States designates, which is China.
Porque China tiene su propia industria.
Because China has its own industry and a capacity that is self-sufficient. That is the difference. But Ukraine is the best example for the world to learn that when countries fall into the hands of the interests of imperialist powers,
de los potencias imperialistas,
small and medium-sized countries, they simply have no future. They cannot expect to escape this dependency or pursue an independent policy while serving those interests.
Es un drama lo de Ucrania.
Ukraine is a tragedy. Today, Ukraine faces over a million deaths, a devastated economy, and a massive wave of immigration, with many fleeing to Russia. Actually, it's important to note that a large part of the Ukrainian migrants have gone to Russia. In other words, a failed Ukraine with a failed state, with a dictator like Zelensky, who, as Donald Trump himself says, has not held elections and has essentially declared himself in power. You are nobody. This is how imperialism treats its lackeys, its servants, when they no longer serve them. It's a lesson that many around the world who serve such powers should heed. Ukraine provides a lesson to those who believe they will always be the darlings of the White House. Look how it's paying.
¿Cómo está pagando? Bueno, la vieja Europa, comillas civilizada, esa misma.
Well, old civilized Europe, the same one that is endorsing the massacres of Syria and in Gaza, the Europe that supports Zelensky is also bankrupt and won't get away without following the United States guidelines. It lacks the capacity.
Seguir las orientaciones de Estados Unidos. No tiene capacidad.
Well, now this tragedy speaks about the need for sovereignty and social justice for the world, countries, and peoples.
Y la justicia social para los países y los pueblos.
This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. ¿Es posible que Ucrania hoy día esté absolutamente a la deriva?
Ukraine may currently feel adrift, relying heavily on support from Western European countries, particularly France and Germany. It's feasible for Europe to engage in a war with Russia through Ukraine without the involvement of the United States. This is possible, both materially and politically. These are questions that people are asking. What is the current situation in Ukraine? What is the reality? Would a change in leadership at the White House lead to a shift in policy? What contradictions exist within American society that have contributed to this situation? To explore these topics further, we have a distinguished guest today. Joining us from Mexico is Dr. Ana Teresa Gutierrez del Cid, an expert in international relations with a specific focus on Russia and Ukraine. Welcome to Black and White, Ana Teresa.
Bienvenida a nuestro programa Negro y Blanco, Ana Teresa.
Muchas gracias, Eduardo.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. It's a pleasure to be on this program.
Ana Teresa, todo el mundo se pregunta.
Ana Teresa, everyone is wondering, is such a drastic political change really possible? How did the occupant of the White House shift their stance on Ukraine so quickly? What are the economic and political foundations behind this?
En fin.
Sí. Bueno, me parece que...
Yes, it seems to me that the American bourgeoisie is divided. On one side, we have the globalist, and on the other, figures like Trump and now Elon Musk, who not long ago was also a globalist. They're attempting to rebuild the economic and social fabric of the United States. This is evident, especially since Trump does not seem to support the broader American populace, but rather favors business owners by reducing their taxes. We are all witness to his erratic policies, including imposing tariffs, not only on trade partners like Mexico and Canada and European countries, but also making threats about taking Greenland. As we know, they'll have to go to a part of Canada. Overall, his approach is quite unpredictable, compared to the globalists, who also have detrimental policies affecting both the world and their own society. Well, we see that since the fall of the Soviet Union. We've seen how the world has been left adrift because the world order that existed based on the structure of Yalta and Potsdam Conference have collapsed, leading to increasing instability. The United States began to assert its influence over territories that were not rightfully theirs, especially during the Cold War, when the military strength of the Soviet Union acted as a restraining force. However, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, we have witnessed a shift. After the tragic events of September the 11th, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, a member of the United Nations, followed by Iraq and then Libya, where they brutally killed its leader. The situation escalated to Syria, where Russia, having interest in the region due to its military base at the port of Tartus, also started to intervene. By 2017, Russia was no longer the weakened state it had been after the Soviet Union's dissolution. This shift aligns with the vision of strategist Zbigniew Brzezinski, a Polish aristocrat who became a key advisor in U.S. foreign policy. In his book, The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives, Brzezinski suggested that Russia should be divided into three parts: Western Europe to the west of the Urals, which would also serve as a source of cheap labor for the European Union and a market for European goods, and a central Siberia to the east of the Urals Mountain.
A la derecha de los Montes Urales.
Ana, vamos a ir un breve...
Ana, we're going to take a short break and we will be right back.
Sure.
Thanks.
Estamos con Ana Teresa Gutiérrez desde México.
We're joined by Ana Teresa Gutierrez from Mexico, delving into the current situation involving the United States, Russia, Ukraine, and of course, NATO. Ana Teresa, you provided a great overview of the goals pursued by those aligned with American financial capital. Today, we see a shift in leadership, perhaps leaning more towards industrial capital, with Donald Trump representing that change. Is it feasible for Ukraine to negotiate a ceasefire or peace amidst these contradictions and the challenges it faces, especially with NATO's involvement? Particularly, countries like England, France, and Germany have their own interests at stake. Given the contradictions, how capable are they of navigating this situation independently of the United States? What do you think about it?
Te dejo la reflexión.
Claro, sí. Bueno, hay que ver que...
Sure, yes, well, it's important to note that Biden continued Brzezinski's approach, turning Ukraine into an anti-Russian initiative. When Trump came into power, he adopted the strategy of another significant political thinker in the U.S., Kissinger. Kissinger consistently advocated, as we saw in 1971, for the separation of Russia from the Soviet Union and China. Today, the approach taken by the United States to counter China, which it views as a major competitor, and unfortunately as an adversary, involves trying to draw closer to Russia. This is evident in a narrative that many young people are dying and that Putin is not the villain the globalists portray him to be, but rather a capable leader. However, the American deep state clearly has no intention of stepping back from this conflict. I believe that behind the Europeans' action lies black soil, which had already been promised access to Ukraine's fertile land and its valuable resources. Ukraine also has raw materials. While Trump aims to win favor and believe he can claim Ukraine's wealth in a rather colonial manner, this blatant colonialism, this barbaric colonialism, is being met with resistance from the Europeans. They're not acting alone. They are also influenced by the interest of the American deep state. What we observe here is that Great Britain is taking the lead, still carrying some of those colonial attitudes from the 19th century that aims to spearhead a new initiative against Russia alongside Macron.
Esta nueva avanzada en contra de Rusia.
Ahora, Ana Teresa, pero es posible.
Is it possible for these countries to launch an advance similar to that of Hitler's Germany or Napoleon's France? Both of them ultimately failed against Russia or the Soviet Union in their times. Without the support of the United States and its military resources, this scenario raises questions. It's important to note that nearly 70% of the iron supplies in Western European countries come from American sources. And it could be a big business when today Donald Trump demands that those countries should arm themselves, buy weapons from the U.S. Here's our factory so you can arm yourselves. Or do you want us to give them away to you? What's going on there? Is it all about trades?
¿Qué pasa ahí? ¿Está el comerciante entre medio?
Claro, totalmente de acuerdo, Eduardo. Eso es...
Of course, I completely agree with you, Eduardo. That's exactly what's happening. Trump is trying to squeeze money from every possible source because of the double debt situation they're facing, both external, particularly with China, and the massive internal debt. The contrast between the U.S. government's financial struggles and its wealthy corporations is stark. Naturally, Trump wants to sell military supplies, but he also has prohibited the use of satellite technology to locate Russian troops that were being provided to Ukraine. As a result, Ukraine is losing ground. We can see that the Europeans are in a tough spot. It's often said that the European Union and its member states are militarily weak, a military dwarf, and have relied on the U.S. nuclear umbrella established after World War II, which they didn't have to pay for. Now Trump is looking to make money for this as well, suggesting that Europe should bear the cost instead of the U.S. spending more on Iran.
Y que gasten los europeos.
Así es, que gasten los europeos.
That's right. Let the Europeans spend. It's possible that the U.S. nuclear umbrella could be replaced by France's, and there have been offers to Germany to establish a nuclear shield there. This could lead to a separation between the U.S. and Europe. What do you think?
Well, I don't think so, because they're very weak. They are very weak. And they have always been under the shelter of the American nuclear umbrella. And they are also countries occupied by NATO troops who are American. Above all, they have Germany. Consequently, they will likely conform to whatever the United States dictates, even if they're facing losses. They have invested a considerable amount of money, not to the same extent as the U.S., but still enough that it could have been used for welfare in Europe. Therefore, it seems to me that Europe cannot separate itself from the United States. They lack the military capability. We've seen how German tanks, including the U.S. Abrams tank, have succumbed against the Russian army. Since Vladimir Putin came to power in 2000, preparations have been underway for a potential confrontation with the West.
Con Occidente.
I was going to ask you something very important. What are the chances of Ukraine sitting at the table as a relevant player today? What are the possibilities that Ukraine has so far?
It's nothing more than a ruthless colonization by the West. It's tragic that a million young Ukrainians have lost their lives. Men who could have started families that were vital for the economy and production of this nation. Today we witness a Ukrainian diaspora, most of whom, interestingly, are in Russia. There's nothing substantial to offer. It's merely a puppet, a result of the anti-Russian agenda that emerged in 2014, following the coup against the president of the Party of Regions, Viktor Yanukovych, who understood how to navigate the ethnic dynamics in a country where the largest minority is Russian, primarily located in the wealthier Donbass region.
Que es en la cuenca del Don, en el Donbass.
Y con una economía que al mismo tiempo.
And with an economy that was simultaneously intimately linked to Russia, its production, its style. Now, is the Russophobia rampant in Europe possible without American oxygen?
Well, es que realmente, Eduardo, quienes perdieron.
Well, Eduardo, the ones who truly lost the most are the Europeans. We saw how Germany was the driving force behind the European Union, successfully establishing Nord Stream 1, which allowed it to grow into a major industrialized and exporting nation after the unification in 1990. However, when the construction of Nord Stream 2 was set to begin, that's when Zelensky's madness erupted. Influenced by the United States and other European nations. Even some factions of the German bourgeoisie shot themselves in the foot because today Germany is now facing a recession. They are purchasing gas from the United States at 4 times the price they used to pay Russia, which provided it securely through pipelines in the Baltic Sea and overland routes. In a fierce interstate competition, the U.S. has successfully taken the gas market away from Russia. Unfortunately, the European people are the ones who matter the least in this situation. Even now, the German bourgeoisie is feeling the impact as companies relocate to the U.S. due to a law enacted by Biden, allowing European businesses to move there because of the energy shortage in Europe. As a result, Europe has completely lost this battle, leading to dire consequences for its population.
That's right, Anna Teresa. Europe not only lost the war, but its people are also bearing the consequences. Nowadays, they need to allocate an additional 5% from their GDP on defense as members of NATO. Well, Anna Teresa, today's program has been excellent, and we really appreciate you joining us here on Black and White. Thank you so much.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atar, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Habib Zata, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So Islam and yoga, is it permissible? I mean, does Islam has any approval regarding yoga? Let's start with you, Brother Habib. How does Islam looks at yoga as a meditation?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. It's very important that when you're talking about Islam, what Islam are you precisely talking about? Because Islam, unfortunately, had been, branched into various sects and ideologies. And for example, I will give you a team, or you'd say a sect, of Muslims who accept this idea, and that is the Sufi. The Sufi ideas accept yoga, and they have their own specific way of meditation, their own specific way of body exercises.
They do not call it yoga.
They have the same, yes. Even if they don't call it yoga, okay. Which they do, of course, they call it yoga. There's this book explaining, interpreting Usul al-Kafi, Kitab al-Ilm, Fadl al-Ilm, Talab al-Ilm, seeking knowledge. The first saying, As-Sayyidun Na'ini, Raf'a, right? One of the great interpreters of Hadith, Allama al-Majlisi always takes from him, of course, both of them high-ranked scholars. And he states the word that there's this concept of yoga where they seek knowledge by doing these exercises.
Okay.
And this is against the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, because we have the teachings of Ahlul Bayt is to seek knowledge, to run after scholars, to look in books, to search for the knowledge, right?
You mean yoga as a method to seek knowledge?
Seek knowledge. There's this kind of yoga. I wrote it down, but I don't know how to pronounce it. Janana, something like that.
Okay.
Right? It's G-N.